You know, just a lot of circumstances pile up and you have a hard time. You have a hard week. And that's what happened to Luke. Luke had a hard week. He had to say goodbye to his friends for a little while. Not forever, just for a little while. He had to take a trip across the galaxy in a rather small spaceship, I think. It was not a full-size or a luxury spaceship. This was economy. He did have a GPS, though, R2-D2. Not a lot of conversation, though, you can have with a GPS across the galaxy, especially if they spend a lot of time saying, recalculating, recalculating, which is what I think R2-D2 said quite a bit. He finally got to the planet he was trying to go to. He'd never been there before. You know what it's like trying to go to a planet you've never been to before. And so he crash-landed on the planet. And I hope it wasn't a rental, because he crash-landed into the swamp of Dagobah. When he got out of the spaceship, his flight suit got wet. And you know, it's a humid climate, sort of like it was last week here. So that flight suit's never really going to dry. That's terrible. But he found some dry land, he got there, and then he was surprised. He was incredibly surprised by what amounted to Frank Oz in a little green puppet outfit. And that sounded a little bit like Grover. And so, you know, after that threat was over and his heart went back into his chest, he was also sort of disturbed to find out that the little green Grover just wanted to eat all his food, which looks like convenience store food. I always was interested in the one that looked like a chicka stick. But it was not a good week. He was looking for a great warrior, and he found a little green Grover. But then he realized that it wasn't a green Grover after all. It was Yoda. It was Yoda, the Jedi Master. So Luke had to sort of come to terms with that. And he had to begin learning and unlearning some things. And so the scene I want to show you from Empire Strikes Back is an important scene, because Luke has been trying to learn the Force. I think his insurance company was willing to offer 12 sessions of Jedi training. That's what they were willing to pay for, at a reduced rate, I'm sure. And so he began to work with Yoda and to figure out the Force a little bit and try to get his spaceship out of the muck. And so he tries, but he's not successful, and he sits down discouraged. And that's where this clip picks up, I think.
I can't. It's too big.
Size matters not. Look at me. Does me by my size, do you? And where you should not. For my ally is the Force. And a powerful ally it is. Life breeds it. Makes it grow. Its energy surrounds us and binds us. Luminous beings are we, not this crude matter. You must feel the Force around you. Here, between you, me, the tree, the rock, everywhere. Yes, even between the land and the ship.
You want the impossible.
I love how much Luke is like a 12-year-old boy. Ah, it's impossible. I so much want Yoda to say near and far, but he never says it, no matter how many times I watch. This is a great clip. Obviously, we sort of, in this moment, get the exposition of the theology and philosophy of the Force. Binds all living things together and its connections between everything. But don't forget the very first thing that Yoda says that's also very significant to us today. Judge me by my size, do you? Luke was not able to really see Yoda. In fact, you can make a case that he never could really see him. He had all these expectations that he brought with him in that ship. He had all these expectations, and he could never really wrap his mind around who Yoda really was. He could never see him for who he was. And that is exactly what happened in the lesson that I read you today from Judges. Judges is an awesome, awesome book. It's great. I was really disappointed that the editors of the story anthologized out my favorite judge, Ehud, who is left-handed. But you'll have to read that on your own time. We can't talk about Ehud today. He gets a brief mention so that you know that he exists. But it's really, this is the story about Deborah the judge. And she sits under the tree of Deborah, which if your name is Deborah, and there is a tree named Deborah, maybe that's where you should be. And so she's there, and people come to her seeking counsel to help them figure out their disputes. So Deborah is a little bit like Yoda, mediating issues. And finally, it's time to deal with the evil king. And so Deborah goes to Barak, the general, and says, this is what's going to happen. Deborah is also a prophet, and so she tells him, look, this is what the Lord says. You're going to go take care of Sisera. It doesn't matter how many great chariots he has, 900, it's mentioned several times, 900 chariots, doesn't matter. You go, take care of it. And Barak says, well, sounds a little cautious. He says, well, I'll go if you go with me. So she says, fine, but the glory's not going to be yours because the Lord will deliver Sisera into the hands of a woman. Now, Barak might be thinking to himself, sure he will, because that's not really expected. But also, Barak might be thinking, sure he will, it's you. You're Deborah. You sit under the tree of Deborah. You're the judge. It's going to be you. So I love how the writer drops these things in. So you're going along, reading this story. It says, now Heber the Kenite. Oh yeah, Heber. Forgot about Heber. Now Heber the Kenite's important because obviously his wife is Jael. Heber the Kenite was a smith. And so he probably was involved in the contract to make some of those 900 chariots. So he is an ally of the king. We need to remember Heber the Kenite. And so then there's the scene with the battle, and it says, at Barak's advance, the Lord routed Sisera and all his chariots and army by the sword, and Sisera got down from his chariot and fled on foot. In journalism, they call that burying the lead. Totally buried the lead. In one sentence, you get the whole battle's done. In the movie, that'd be 20 minutes, but right here it's just one line. Sisera gets down on foot, he runs. And he runs and he runs and he runs. And he flees on foot all the way to the tent of Jael, the wife of Heber the Kenite. Jael goes out to meet him and says, come, my lord, come right in. Don't be afraid. And so he enters into her tent, and she covers him with a blanket. He might think, she's hiding me. We might think, she's about to do something dastardly. And so we read that scene. He says, I'm thirsty, give me some water to drink. She does one better. She opens a skin of milk. This is the beginning of lactose intolerance, I'll just tell you. Sorry, I had to make that joke. I think about it all week long. This is the beginning of lactose intolerance. She gives him a skin of milk, probably goat milk. Then he tells her, kind of bossy, stand in the doorway. If anyone says, is anyone there? You say no. But Jael, it says, Heber's wife, picks up the tent peg and the hammer and went quietly to him while he lay fast asleep, exhausted. And we know how that ends up. Sisera was never able to see Jael for who she was. He never saw her as a person. He never saw her as an equal. He never really saw her as a threat. He saw her as the wife of an ally of the king. He didn't see her for who she was. And not seeing her face to face, that was a huge mistake. Now, we haven't done dead theologians in a while, so let me show you a picture. This is not a dead theologian. Noah says, I always show you pictures of dead theologians. So this right here, coming up on the screen, in any second. is not a dead theologian. This is a dead philosopher, because I want to change it up a little bit. This is a picture of Emmanuel Levinas. You can keep your Stanley Hauerwas. You can keep your Jürgen Habermas. I want my Emmanuel Levinas. Now, doesn't he look fun? I look. He's moving his hands and talking. He would be great at the meet and eat group if he wasn't dead. But he is. And so Emmanuel Levinas was a philosopher, Lithuanian, but writes in French. Eventually was a professor at the Sorbonne, which is not the same as Cinnabon, because that's different. That's at the airport. Sorbonne's in France. And so he had a lot of interesting things to say about seeing the other face to face. And so I tried to find a couple quotes that were not totally confusing and 50 words long. So let's see how we did. The first quote, he says, "In the face of the other expresses his immanence the dimension of height and divinity from which he descends." Yeah, that didn't make any sense. The idea is when you see the other, you're encountering a mystery. You're not encountering just a thing, but you're encountering a person. And the idea of seeing the other, it opens us up to an infinite amount of experiences. That's kind of what he's pointing toward. Let's do this next one and see where it goes. Oh, this is a long one. Man. "The way in which the other presents himself, exceeding the idea of the other in me, we here name face. The face of the other at each moment destroys and overflows the plastic image it leaves me, the idea existing to my own measure. It expresses itself." So when we encounter the other, if we truly encounter the other, we're not dealing with what we think they are, or this plastic image of our expectations, our preconceptions. We're dealing with the other face to face, and this encounter with the other is an almost infinite encounter. And this makes sense because he has a Jewish heritage, so he would have this idea of the image of God, and when we encounter the other, we're encountering the image of God. This is what it means to encounter the other face to face. And all our encounters, he talks about, are coming to terms. We have to come to terms with the other and sort of negotiate our existence with the other. The other has a claim on us. We have a responsibility to the other when we encounter them face to face. Okay, you can take that off the screen now. So when you and I deal with people face to face, the way that Luke and Yoda were trying to deal with each other, the way that Jael and Sisera really were not able to deal with each other, we learn this early. We come to terms with the other first in our parents. I remember when I was about Noah's age, I was about 11 or 12, I was sitting at this restaurant in Huber Heights, Ohio, called Rob's Restaurant. It was owned by Rob. Yeah, good idea. I wonder how long he spent naming that. Anyway, we're sitting there, and I had this sort of epiphany moment. I was sitting there, and I realized, you're my parents. And it wasn't like a bad thing, like, you guys, this is so embarrassing, you're my parents. It was like, you, of all people in the whole world, you two are my parents. And it was the beginning of a kind of coming to terms. It was the beginning of a kind of face-to-face where I could see them in a different way. I had never thought about it before. And every now and then it would kind of come up. You. Face-to-face. I think we do this with our siblings too. I don't have any experience of this because I'm an only child, but I hear that having siblings is a negotiation. Face to face, you're with each other your whole lives, and then you bury your parents, and you deal with that, and maybe you even bury each other, but it's a face to face kind of thing. But the supreme example for me of what it is to come face to face with the other is marriage. Marriage is the ultimate face to face. We had a great celebration here yesterday, Janice and Randy Poindexter, their 50th anniversary. It was awesome. They renewed their vows. We're very happy for them. But I was just thinking about how marriage is a face-to-face experience, you know? It's a side-by-side experience, sure, where you do everything together and you raise the kids and you have the career and you deal with what life throws you. You have to pay the phone bill every single month. But it's face-to-face. And when you come together in that church and you say those vows, love, cherish, till death do us part, you have no idea what you're getting into. You have no idea what you're doing. But you're making a commitment to see each other face to face. And it is a mystery. I remember, I think it was in the first year of marriage when Elizabeth and I were together. We were at a party and you know, you just have chit-chat and somebody said, Elizabeth, what's your favorite movie? So I do a bunch of things on my head right away. I worry, are they going to ask me next? What's my favorite movie? So I have to go through, like, is Star Wars? Is it The Godfather? Should I say Heat? Because it's not a trilogy, and it was directed by Michael Mann, and he directed Miami Vice, and that was so good, and really liked that. And Al Pacino and Robert De Niro, you can't go wrong with that. And even though they were all also together, and got, you know, so I'm doing that. I'm also thinking, what's she going to say? Probably going to go for Tom Hanks, Meg Ryan. Maybe Sleepless in Seattle. Maybe You've Got Mail. Both those are good. Not When Harry Met Sally, because Billy Crystal's good, but he's no Tom Hanks. I'm doing that. And I hear Elizabeth say, probably Die Hard. Or maybe one of the Matrix movies. And I'm totally out of my head now. What? Who are you? I have to learn to see you face to face. I have to come to terms with this other person who is not the plastic image I have in my head, but is a mystery, near infinite, really. Now, I heard a phrase when I watched the presidential debate the other night, and I've been dying to use it. Chris Wallace, at least twice, said, let's drill down. We had professors in seminary. They underscored things. They bracketed things. We never drilled down on anything. I'm so excited today to be with you to drill down for the first time. We're going to drill down on this. What is this about, this seeing the other face to face? It's about faith. It's about faith. Not faith as risking, right? Or reaching out. I love that. Remember the definition for faith when it's that. It's not that. Not faith as surrender or kenosis or a pouring out. Although it's definitely that. Faith is offering, is sacrifice. This isn't even faith, which is our favorite as Presbyterians. This isn't even faith that's thinking. We love thinking. Because if you think, you don't have to do anything. We love thinking about our faith, confessing our faith and thinking our faith and expressing our faith. It's not that either. This is faith that is seeing. Faith that's seeing, that's perceiving, that's not thinking, but knowing and being known. All these things are tied together in this sort of constellation of what it means to have the eyes of faith to see the other as other, as mystery, as near infinite. This is what we want. This is what we're striving toward, to have these eyes of faith and maybe even have some corrected lenses put in to help us to see. The eyes of faith lead us very quickly to the ears of the heart. And so one of the things that we're interested in doing, and stewardship is a perfect time for it. Stewardship is great because it's a great time for us to think about our values. Think about what's important to us. Think about the direction we're headed and if that's where we want to go. And so the eyes of faith lead us to the ears of the heart because we want to listen to one another. It doesn't take long when you're looking at the other face to face where you need to speak. Levinas even says that the face calls forth speech. And so we have to listen to one another. And so today, when we have our stewardship brunch, there's nothing worse than the thought of having a preacher preach again right after he just preached. So what we're going to do is around the tables, there's a few sheets of paper, and I'll just lead you through some speaking and listening exercises where we'll just be face-to-face and we'll share some things, and they'll be easy. And there's an insert in the bulletin about some listening sessions that will happen on the 1st and the 3rd of November, I believe, and you can read about that, and you can sign up for those in Malden Hall, where Reverend Dr. Kathleen Weller, a wonderful woman, is going to help us and our congregation see each other face-to-face and listen to each other with the ears of the heart. And so I'm really excited about those two things that are happening. Today in the gospel lesson, we heard the story of the rich young ruler. My favorite joke about that is that the sermon that a young pastor had 3 points. He was rich, he was young, he was a ruler. That wasn't funny. Not one of you laughed at that. Well, but you laughed at that, so that's fine. But the thing I love about this, and it's not in Matthew and it's not in Luke, it's only in little Mark, and poor Mark gets ignored all the time. Jesus is going along his way. And I can't really tell if Jesus is annoyed, but it's coming off as he's just distracted or maybe annoyed. And the young man runs up to him and says, "Good teacher, what must I do to inherit eternal life?" And Jesus says, "Why do you call me good? Nobody's good but God. Follow the law. I'm on my way." And then he says, "But I've done all that." And Jesus stops. And did you see it? He looks at him and loves him. He looks at him with the eyes of faith. That's what we want. We want to look at one another with the eyes of faith and see each other. Amen.